Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to do your own reading around the topics we discuss.
Hello everyone and welcome to our latest episode of the podcast. Today I've got me, Mike Weeble, and I'm pleased to have Ben Chadwick, the current SAC Chair for Acute Medicine at the JRCPTB, and Gordon McKinnon, one of your trainee reps, joining me. And we're going to have a bit of a chat about the new curriculum, really, and ask Ben some questions. So to start off with that, I'm going to give Ben a bit of chance from his perspective to say what he thinks useful to talk about with the curriculum, and we'll take it from there. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for inviting me on, first of all. The acute medicine curriculum has been quite a long process in terms of getting a new curriculum set up. It started a number of years ago, at the same time that all the medical curricula were going to be revamped. And really what it did for us, as I think as a speciality and as a group on the SAC, was enabled us to have a really good think about what we thought acute medicine was as a speciality, and give us a bit of a chance to define it in our own terms. So those of you that have trained on the old curriculum will be well aware that there are a lot of similarities and crossover between the acute internal medicine curriculum and the GIM curriculum. And what this curriculum change gave us an opportunity to do was to put ourselves on an equal footing with all the other medical specialities, really. And it was a really helpful thing to think about what we thought were the really important key concepts in our speciality. So, as you all know, I'm sure, the new curricula are all... The idea is to move away from some of the tick box type issues that we had with the old curricula, and they're much more holistic and describe things called entrustable activities, where you essentially describe a situation which you might be in as a consultant or an acute medicine physician. And so we went away and had a think about what our SIPs would be, and we came up with six, which what we hope is that they describe fairly clearly what we do as acute medicine professionals on a day-to-day basis, really. And once that was done, really a lot of the discussions were what else should be within training. And obviously the biggest change between the old curriculum and this new curriculum has been the introduction of point-of-care ultrasound competencies as a core part of the curriculum rather than as a specialist skill, which it was previously. So there was a lot of work done around that. First of all, to decide whether we thought it was sensible to put them in the curriculum. And really the feeling from pretty much everybody that we talked to was that it would be a really good thing to have in the curriculum. And part of the curriculum design process is around making sure that whatever you put in the curriculum is going to be deliverable and deliverable across four nations. So once we decided in principle that it would be a good idea to have point of care ultrasound competencies in the curriculum, we then had to do a lot of work trying to make sure that once they were in the curriculum, it was going to be deliverable and we were going to be able to train people. And Nick Smallwood was absolutely instrumental in that. You know, the acute medicine famous course has been running for many years, and we've got to the stage really where there's a sufficient number of supervisors that we can deliver the training. And certainly deaneries were given lots of notice that this was going to happen, and to enable them to start thinking about getting people through famous courses to be accredited in time for the new curriculum. I think one of the other big things I wanted to get out of the new curriculum was a really key commitment towards having time to train, both in the new ultrasound competencies and also in the specialist skills. So certainly the feedback that we've had for a very long period of time was that people were finding it difficult to get time away to deliver their specialist skill, for instance. And we wanted to make it absolutely explicit within the curriculum that there would be time to train. And it was a bit of a beast getting it through all the various different stages, and we're still not 100% through at the moment. So the one outstanding document that still needs to be approved is the specialist skills document. I'm hopeful that will be approved in the next couple of months, and then we'll have everything done, really.
Okay, well, that's really helpful. I was going to say, Gordon, have you got any particular questions that jump out for you?
Yeah, I think there's lots of videos to touch on. I think the first point is that the new curriculum looks quite different to the old curriculum, and there's not going to be people having to go around looking for patients with genital discharge or urticaria or these kind of obscure symptoms that you've got to get links to. It's more general and competency-based, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that it's a really quite a big change in emphasis, actually. And, you know, my personal view of it is it's a much better way of thinking about your training. So it is less about, as you've described, being down in the very detail of, oh my gosh, I haven't got a case-based discussion on somebody with genital discharge and ulceration. It's much more about thinking, well, what are the things I need to be able to do as a consultant? How good am I at them now? What evidence have I got that shows my progress against them? And how am I gonna plan my training going forward? And it's those bigger picture discussions, I think, which are much more able to be facilitated by the curriculum with your educational supervisor, rather than your educational supervisor meetings being taken up by you going through line by line through a portfolio to make sure that you've got enough evidence to get through your ARCP. So I think it's a really welcome change in emphasis. I think it makes people a bit nervous, especially when they've been used to a very kind of rigid, I know exactly what I need to do. And I think in the new way of doing things, the relationship between a trainee and the educational supervisor is a really key relationship, and having an educational supervisor who knows you well and understands your kind of capabilities and things is a really, really key thing.
Yeah, and I think many of us have been supervisors for IMT for a few years now, and have seen that change and the different framed conversations that it kind of encourages compared to the tick box exercise. So I'm certainly optimistic as a trainer that it very much reframes that kind of discussion and that dialogue as an educational supervisor supporting a trainee.
And it's kind of aligned with the IMT curriculum as well, isn't it? A lot of the terminology is similar to people who have gone through that process will be familiar with some of the concepts. Is more an extension of that rather than
so obviously our curriculum, our acute internal medicine curriculum, is a group one speciality, and therefore it includes all the SIPs that people who've come through IM training will be very familiar with. So the 6 generic SIPs and I think it's 8 speciality SIPs for internal medicine are exactly the same as they were in the previous curriculum that people will have worked to, but you're expected to be entrusted to a higher level in those. So it's very much a continuation of internal medicine training, but then the additional bolt-on stuff is the acute medicine SIPs, and there are 6 of those. And again, as I mentioned earlier, that puts us on a very similar footing as all the other medical specialities and all the other Group 1 specialities who have their between about 6 and 8 SIPs for most of the specialities.
Excellent. I suppose one of the hot topics that feels like, I suspect there's a group of trainees out there that worry about, are the people that are already on the current curriculum and the kind of transition arrangements. I don't know if you've got anything particularly you want to say about that.
Yeah, so we were very conscious whilst we were thinking about what went into the new curriculum. We were very conscious of the group. There's always going to be a group of trainees who are caught between old and new curricula. And we wanted to, what we didn't want to do was to have trainees transitioning onto a new curriculum, which for instance, had the additional point of care ultrasound competencies, and then them not being able to achieve those additional competencies in time and perhaps leading to an extension of training. So we negotiated a longer transition period than most of the other specialities have. So we negotiated a 2-year transition period on the basis that people would need that additional time to achieve the point of care ultrasound training competencies if they hadn't already. And obviously there will be a lot of people who are on an old curriculum who wouldn't have been doing those point of care ultrasound skills. So hopefully we've made it as easy as possible for those that are having to transition onto the new curriculum to have the time so that their CCT isn't delayed and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so I'm in that group that are not transitioning because I'm far enough through training, but I do think other than the ultrasound component, it should be a relatively smooth transition. The workplace-based assessments and things that people have done previously should be transferable to the...
Yeah, so there's... So, I mean, one of the important things to say about that is that, you know, if you are transitioning from the old curriculum onto the new curriculum, then what you don't have to do is go back and do. So, for instance, if you've done 2 years of internal medicine AIM training already, there is no need for you to look back at those 2 years of training, all your work-based placed assessments, and link them to the new curriculum. It's very much the idea is, okay, you're now on the new curriculum, just start building evidence against that from now. So I wouldn't want people to think that there will be a huge amount of busy work in terms of portfolio things. It should just be, you know, a conversation with your educational supervisor about how the new curriculum works and thinking about, okay, how much time do I have left? Where are the areas I need to focus on? And then collecting evidence going from that sure. point forward.
That's good to know. I think the area that we hear about kind of as trainee reps that people are most concerned about is the provision of point of care ultrasound, and not everywhere has a supervisor on site kind of at the moment. If you've got any advice for trainees in that position?
Yeah, so obviously, as I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest bits of work really we did around the new curriculum was trying to get everybody as prepared as possible. Well, first of all, to convince everybody across, you know, the four nations that ultrasound training was deliverable everywhere. And, you know, as part of that, people have had plenty of advance warning. So we looked at how many trainees. So we've given TPDs, for instance, estimates of roughly how many supervisors you would expect to need, depending on the size of your training program, for instance. It's going to be really important that people who are trainers in ultrasound have the time to do that. So we made some recommendations around kind of time that you could expect to use to mentor somebody through their ultrasound training. I mean, we can make recommendations, but we don't have any power beyond that, unfortunately. And we identified fairly early on that there are some deaneries which are in a very, very good position with having people who can supervise people in ultrasound, and there are others where there's more work to be done. What we'd always recognised was that it was likely to be the first 2 or 3 years of a new curriculum that were going to be the most challenging period to make sure we can get everybody through. Once you've been through that initial challenging period, it should become self-perpetuating, because actually we will then have a load of people who are trained in ultrasound who can act as supervisors, and it's almost like a snowball effect. But what we are very much hoping is that individual TPDs, individual deaneries will have their own setups, and that they will have thought about this ahead of time. That the fact that we're kind of fencing off the equivalent of a day a week for ultrasound training right from the beginning does also mean that that opens up the option of traveling within a deanery, for instance. So, okay, I'm in X place. There isn't anybody who can directly supervise me doing my ultrasound training there, but actually in Trust Y, there is somebody, and I can travel there on those days. And increasingly, you know, remote supervision is going to be entirely possible as well once you get to a certain stage. So what I hope is that there is the kind of backup within the curriculum to say you need this time to train, and a willingness on the you know, host deanery to train people.
I was going to say, with the new curriculum, the idea is that people do their ultrasound training within the first couple of years of their acute training and then go on to do their specialist skill afterwards. Will there be a degree of flexibility in that initially, as there may be less trainers?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when we were designing the ARCP decision aids, for instance, what we wanted to try and do was to get people training in ultrasound from the very beginning of their training. What we didn't want to happen was that there'd almost be a kind of fallow period at the start of training where actually you were just kind of getting into the whole registrar thing, and maybe you hadn't started your point of care ultrasound training, you hadn't started your specialist skill, and then that becoming a real pinch point, you know, as you move into the years 3 and 4 of your training program. So because we know that everybody is going to do point of care ultrasound training, then hopefully you can start that right from the beginning. And we recognize that different people will attain these competencies at different rates. And for some people, it will take a shorter period of time. For other people, it will take longer. And hopefully there's the flexibility over the 4 years of the program to allow everybody to get their ultrasound competencies and then have the time to also develop a specialist skill later on in the training program.
I do think it's a really good introduction to the curriculum. Like, I did the famous course last year, and I surprised myself actually by how often I stick a probe in someone, like during the word round. It's a really useful skill to have. You spoke a bit about having the day a week of protected time to develop that skill. What should trainees do if they're struggling to get that?
So I think the first thing I would always encourage people to do is really at your first meeting with your educational supervisor, that's the time to talk about, okay, this is where I am in my training. I'm expected to develop point of care ultrasound competencies. I should have the equivalent of a day a week to do that. How's that actually going to work? So how are we going to do this? And what I hope is that a lot of the, if you like, the logistics of the ultrasound training will be handled by TPDs and deaneries, in terms of, you know, it shouldn't be up to the trainee to then go, okay, well, I need to find a supervisor. I'll just email 3 different people with it. You know, hopefully that will be arranged for them. But almost certainly on an individual job basis, it will need to be a discussion around, well, how are you going to release me for this bit of my training? And we've used throughout the curriculum, I think, the equivalent of a day a week. So for a lot of people, that may be what it is, and it may be, well, Tuesday will be my ultrasound day or whatever. In other places, it may not work like that, and it may actually make more sense to do blocks of ultrasound training, for instance. But there's the flexibility to do that. But I think what I would be very keen is that people do get that equivalent of a day a week, however it happens, as long as it happens. I think, you know, if you're struggling with that, then obviously educational supervisor is your first port of call. And hopefully that will be enough to sort out the vast majority of kinks and problems. If you're not able to resolve that locally with your educational supervisor, then really the next person to flag it up would be your training program director in your local deanery, just saying, look, I'm not managing to get this. How are you going to help? So I think it is about educational supervisor first, and if not, then escalating to TPDs. And I think, you know, I would very much encourage people to do that. I think sometimes there's almost a slightly fatalistic thing that happens, that trainees don't get the time, and they don't get the time, and, oh, this is a bit rubbish, I haven't got the time. And the risk with that is it just goes on for a period of 6 to 8 months. Nothing really happens, and all of a sudden you're going to have to be catching up on your training. So I think flagging it early and making sure that actually it is going to happen, I think, is really key.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You don't want to get to a few weeks before your ACP and then kind of raise it at that point where it's too late to kind of remedy addressing it early.
It's like most things in training, being organised and raising questions early gives trainers chance to respond and deal with issues So yeah, that's really good. I suppose a question that comes up for me is a little bit, as you've alluded to, there have been some delays around kind of clarity around special skill aspects of things at the moment, and what you can share or feel able to share about where that's at and what some of the challenges have been around some of that.
So the challenges have been many and varied. What I would say is that, so I'm fairly happy that the people who approve the new curriculum are, they are happy with the concept of a specialist skill. So they are happy with the idea that people will develop another string to their bow during their acutements and training. And really, it's just about the language around how that is expressed and how it is delivered. And like with the ultrasound training, it has to be deliverable across, you know, all four nations. And, you know, obviously not every deanery will be able to provide every specialist skill once the list is approved, but every deanery will have to be able to provide at least one. And, you know, so a lot of the work has been around expressing the specialist skills in a language that now fits with SIPs and entrustable activities and those kind of things. And, you know, the other issue has been around, you know, the GMC and the education bodies who approve the new curricula have been very, very clear that you can't mandate specific courses in any of the curricula. And so it's been thinking a bit more creatively about how we keep the good things around medical education as a specialist skill, for instance, acknowledging the fact that we would no longer be able to say you need to achieve a postgraduate diploma or a postgraduate certificate in medical education. And that's been quite challenging, actually. And inevitably, what it has meant is that there's been a degree of compromise. So we did a lot of work kind of standardizing what the skills look like. And I think that will be really helpful because they very much grew up in an organic way over many years. And it got to the stage where it was all a bit of a mismatch, really. So I think there's been some good work in terms of standardizing it. And I think there will be opportunities to have conversations again in the future about how we perhaps make them even stronger going forward. I'm hopeful that it will all be approved in the next couple of months, but I feel like I've been saying that for a while. So watch this space, I suppose.
Do you have any advice for trainees at the moment that are maybe trying to decide what they want to do as their specialist skill while things are a little bit up in the air?
Yeah, so I think it's obviously very difficult because if you are training on the new curriculum, then at the moment there isn't a specialist skills document for you to look at. What I would say is that the specialist skills document for the old curriculum, the skills are highly likely to be the same. It will just be how they're expressed and the language that will be different. So if, for instance, you had been clear, had you been doing the old curriculum, that you would want to do medical education, for instance, then I would say, yes, fine, you know, that would be absolutely fine. The detail will follow fairly shortly, but by all means, start thinking about how you might train in medical education or how you might train in diabetes, for instance. You know, the core skills will be very similar, but it will be a little bit different in terms of how they're expressed in terms of language and also how they're assessed.
And presumably people can liaise with their educational supervisors and TPDs and how those skills have been achievable previously in the
classroom.
Any other questions you've got at the minute, Gordon?
I was just going to ask if you've had any feedback from trainees. Yes, it's obviously relatively early. It's not been around for that long.
Not anything formal, if you see what I mean. I think, you know, we get some feedback from trainees through our kind of committees, so the specialist advisory committee at the college, and from trainee reps from SAM as well. And I think overall, what we've got back through those mechanisms seems to be that people are reasonably happy, which is nice. Like I said right at the beginning, I think that hopefully what the new curriculum does is it strengthens acute medicine generally as a speciality. It puts it on a firmer footing alongside all the other medical specialities as being something in of its own right. Yeah. And I think the curriculum does that. I think, you know, overall, we didn't fiddle too much with the structure of acute medicine training in terms of we still felt that experience in cardiology, respiratory, geriatrics and intensive care was a really core part of the program that we wanted to keep. But it's really the language around it and hopefully the identification of this is what makes an acute physician as opposed to somebody who's just trained in general internal medicine, for instance. So what is our unique thing? And I think we are a very unique speciality. And I think there is a big difference between somebody who is training in the internal medicine SIPs as part of their respiratory training, for instance, and somebody who's doing acute medicine. I think that the product will look very, very different.
Yeah, I think that really comes across. Like, I think it looks great, and I think it's really important that we've got a good sense of identity. As a former Take Aim fellow, we've had people come up to our stand and say, "What are you not just a general physician? Like, what makes you special as an acute physician?" And I think incorporating things like managing same-day emergency care and managing risk, kind of having those things embedded within the curriculum is really useful.
Thank you both for your time. I hope people listening to this find it useful. I want to put on record from myself personally, as somebody who had a small chance to influence things, but I think Sam as a whole, to thank Ben and everybody that worked with Ben for all the hard work on getting through many hurdles to get to what, like I said, like you said, Gordon, I agree is a significant step forward for us as a specialty and as a training situation. So thank you for that. Everyone listening, please do let us have your feedback and again, do reach out to us through Twitter and other means about other topics you'd love to hear us cover on the podcast. So thank you. Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website at www.acutemedicine.org.uk for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod. And let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd love to see us explore in future episodes, or if you'd like to just get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.